On a Monday, we're looking at the economic repercussions of the pandemic. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Some investors are betting on a quick V-shaped recovery rather than the longer, slower swoosh shape that economists have been talking about. Meanwhile, Apple is reclosing nearly a dozen stores in four states where cases of the coronavirus have climbed. It's the latest indicator of wariness in the business sector about the safety of reopening in some places. Do you own a business? Have you had to lay off employees or close shop altogether? How are you coping? Let's talk about the state of our economy. Your questions about it front and center, 800-642-1234. We have Menzi Chin for the hour. He's a public affairs and economics professor at UW-Madison. Menzi, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Well, thanks for having me on, Kate.
So the U.S. economy officially entered a recession in February. That marked the end of the longest expansion in the U.S. What measures dictate when an economy is officially in recession and then when the recession is over?
Okay, well, the National Bureau of Economic Research, which is a think tank mainly based in Cambridge, Massachusetts, originated the idea of business cycles and hence recessions and expansions. And so what this committee looks at is that it examines employment, industrial production, personal income, and manufacturing and trade sales, and then a whole slew of other indicators, including GDP, to figure out if there's been a broad decline or increase in economic activity. So all these things that you think of as being important, they're all in there in some way, and no single measure determines whether the committee is going to think we're in an expansion or contraction.
Okay, so it's a mix of numbers, but then when do those numbers turn and when do economists say, okay, recession is over now? What do you look at, you know, when do you deem it that a recession is over?
Well, that's the complicated thing. People think there's a simple rule of, you know, if gross domestic product, which is the broadest measure we have of economic activity, is going down for two quarters continuously or consecutively, we're in a recession. But that's just a rule of thumb. And then, so when you go to the real life, real world problem of determining a recession, the problem is some things are going up, some things are going down. Industrial production, for instance, had been, you know, trending downward for months before, you know, we had this big, big, big drop in employment, you know. And so you think about it, you have some indicators going up, some going down. And on top of that, these indicators get revised over time. So, like, you know, if we're looking back at May's employment numbers, which were just reported a couple weeks ago in June, early June, you know, that's more an estimate than it is a hard, fast number. So it's really hard. Mm-hmm. People try to think about, you know, what does it mean to have most of economic activity going down or up? And the NBER, this committee within the NBER, waits a long time, typically, months and months and months, to determine after the numbers have been revised and we're able to see all the numbers in context, whether to declare us in a recession or an expansion, and even longer to declare us out of a recession. So, you know, they're not really interested in saying right away, are we in a recession? It's more for the sake of history, the demarking, you know, are we in or out of an expansion or contraction?
So at what point in time do we go from, say, like a one-quarter or a two-quarter downturn with a rebound to a prolonged, difficult, you know, to recover from economic depression?
You know, this is a really difficult question, even though it's probably the most important issue that faces us. And I guess it shows the limitations of these terms. You know, for economists, you know, recession is a technical term. It's the economy contracting, and expansion is it's growing. And you might say, well, gee, if it's growing, it's good. But, you know, the point is you can be growing very slowly and you could be very far below where the economy should in some sense be producing. And that's not necessarily good. So for the last recession we had, what we call the Great Recession, which started in 2007, you know, technically the recession ended in mid-2009. But if you ask somebody in mid-2009 or, you know, one quarter after that, are things good? Well, no, because the economy was operating like 6 to 7% below what it could have produced. Expanding, contracting is only part of the story. How fast you are and where the economy is relative to where it could be is a difficult question, and just as important. In this particular episode, we are confronted with a lot of things that make it more difficult to figure out where we are and where we're going and how long it'll take to recover fully to where we were before. Just because, we don't usually have recessions in the middle of pandemics, and the political sphere is one where, it's hard to see how the chips will fall. Will the government undertake more policies or not, or be stuck in a logjam?
We're talking about the recession with UW-Madison professor Menzi Chin, who teaches public affairs and economics, taking your questions on the economy. What do you think the future holds? What parallels do you see between this recession and the Great Recession, or what contrasts? We're at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Menzi, we have an email here. Myra writes to us saying, we're all wondering when things will start to feel, air quotes here, normal again. Imagine running a business that relies heavily on in-store foot traffic to hit sales goals and projections. When will we finally bounce back to those high shopping levels we saw in 2019?
That's an excellent question, and it's with some trepidation that I say anything about this, exactly because of so many of the uncertainties that confront us in this particular situation. For an economist can usually look at and say, well, here are these financial indicators, here are some economic indicators, and then make a guess about the politics. But here, you have to make a guess about also. Two things. How readily does the virus spread in either summer or in the fall? And secondly, given that the vaccine is at a minimum, let's say a year away, widely available at least, then what is the government's response in terms of public health and in terms of government economic policies? I would guess that, if the pandemic and the surge in cases that we're seeing right now is any indication, we unlike almost any other advanced economy in the world, have not gotten the virus under control. Caseloads are rising in net over the whole U.S., where it's declining in any other advanced economy you can think of.
Beijing also shut down this morning.
That's right. So Beijing has shut down flights after reopening them for a while, and it's reimposed lots of restrictions. China in general was one of the most successful in closing down things. Even South Korea, which had barely several hundred deaths, has had these hotspots flash up in terms of infections. So, we in the United States are nowhere near that. You might think we're kind of treading water in terms of caseload, but if you take out New York and New Jersey, where we had this dramatic reduction, the rest of the country is seeing this incredible resurgence. So you have to make a guess in your assessments about how the governors in these states and how the localities respond in the situation where caseloads are rising. If they, for the short term, say, okay, we can deal with deaths at whatever rate that they're going at right now. In Wisconsin, I think it's averaging, eight deaths associated with COVID directly.
And we have to pause right there with UW-Madison Professor of Public Affairs and Economics, Menzi Chin, who is our guide. We'll be back in a moment on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're looking at the fiscal response to the COVID-19 crisis. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The U.S. economic response so far is in the $2 trillion CARES Act and a massive injection of liquidity into the financial system by the Fed's balance sheet, by the way, has expanded by some $3 trillion since March. Here's U.S. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin earlier this month on CNBC saying he'd do more to juice the economy if need be.
We're prepared to go back to Congress for more money to support the American worker. So we're going to get everybody back to work. That's my number one job, working with the president, and we're going to do that.
Is there a need for a second wave of stimulus? If the virus surges again, what should the U.S. policy response be for businesses? Is your business staying afloat? Join in 800-642-1234. We have UW-Madison Public Affairs and Economics Professor Menzi Chin as our guide. Menzi, as we were going there to break, you know, you're talking about how governors respond, how that can influence how the economy will respond to the pandemic.
Yes, I mean, I think one question is, what's the trade-off we're willing to assume in the short run in terms of cases and deaths in exchange for trying to keep the economy open? Now, part of that is there's no trade-off because if, you know, the infection breaks out like wildfire, like it is tending to be in, say, Florida, and fatalities ensue, well, in the longer run, you'll have to shut down even more fully and maybe for a longer period of time, and or you'll have more people dropping out of the labor force because they're sick, disabled, or dead. But we don't know exactly what those trade-offs are and, you know, how much we'll have this hit to, you know, both population and employment and economic activity yet, because we're still learning more about the virus. So I guess that's one way of punting the question.
Yeah.
We just don't know. And we just don't know, you know, some governors are willing apparently to take a big hit in loss of life or gamble that there won't be a big hit. And then some governors haven't had the power to lock down things taken away from them. And then, you know, localities can, in some cases, undertake their own measures. So, you know, if I were doing forecasting, I would say, wow, this is really hard because I don't even have a unified national policy on shutdowns. I just have these statements about recommendations that come out of the federal government, which even the president, you know, sort of dismisses out of hand. So, you know, what is the policy that's coming down? It's not even an integrated policy. It's a whole patchwork quilt.
Well, in this patchwork quilt, can you explain for us some of the shapes we're seeing in terms of recovery? We heard of a V curve, a W, an L, mm-hmm. and a swoosh. What do they all mean?
Okay, so, it is a kind of a mishmash of letters, and I guess economists like letters. V is quite simple. It's like, it was the early favored scenario of, let's say, government officials in the administration saying, well, we'll just take this big hit very quickly because, you know, this is a shutdown. It's a voluntary shutdown of the economy in many ways. Just to get the virus under control, we put the economy kind of in a temporary coma so that it can recover. And then once you take off these restrictions and we've dealt with the virus, then people have all this pent-up demand because they've been stuck inside and they want to go to restaurants and want to spend. And so economic activity surges and you're back to where you were before because the virus didn't really destroy anything, you know, in terms of, you know, machinery and buildings and so forth. That's the V. That's kind of the best that you could hope for. W is sort of, in some ways, my scenario I'm tending more towards now. It's one where you get part of that snapback because you lift the restrictions. But in the case of the United States, as I said, we haven't controlled the pandemic. And in stark contrast to the other advanced developed economies, we have a rising caseload infections. And so, you know, the question is, in Florida, for instance, in Arizona, then at some point, do they shut down the economy? Well, then you go back into reduced economic activity. And then, and I'd say, you know, some estimates are like a third to a half of the counties in the U.S. in terms of GDP have rising caseloads. So that's a real possibility. It's not the baseline scenario for most people, but it's a possibility they're considering. Swoosh is like a Nike swoosh. Mm-hmm. That is big hit and then a very slow sort of plodding recovery, which could occur because we have lots of uncertainty going forward. Who wants to build a new factory, hire a whole bunch of new workers when you don't know what will be the demand for your product 6 months from now, whether you can get the parts for your product or the workers for your product, and you don't know what the government policy is going to be?
We're talking about the economy with Menzi Chin, a public affairs and economics professor at UW-Madison. He's taking your questions. How do you want to see the federal government assist Americans right now? Do you want to see more stimulus money? And then how do you pay for it? Join in at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Menzi, let's look in particular at the Federal Reserve. I've been watching to see what the heck they're going to do. With interest rates as basically low as you can go, how does the government pay for the spending right now? And what is the role of the Federal Reserve in buying back bonds right now?
Excellent question. I mean, the way to think about it, just to make a distinction, there are two major sets of policies that the government as a whole is undertaking. First, there's the federal government via the executive branch and the Congress, and they're spending money in the sense of they're buying products, or they're giving, they're hiring civil servants or people to track COVID, or they're giving transfers and like Social Security checks. Okay, that's spending, and it's true the federal government has to borrow either from us, private households, from the Chinese, by selling them government bonds, or they can sell it to the public and the Federal Reserve can buy them. And that's, the Fed has essentially committed to doing that. So the Fed, in that sense, can keep buying and financing the spending of the federal government per se for a long time, until you think inflation is going to kick up and make things problematic with rising prices. But we have, that was a worry back in 2009, 2010 on the part of some people, never materialized. In fact, we could never get the inflation rate consistently to the target, couldn't get it up to the target that the Fed had set. But there are always people who worry about inflation regardless of the situation. And I can't promise you won't get it this time, but so far, little sign that it's on the horizon. Now, the Fed itself can do other things. Now, think about how interest rates can spur the economy. If interest rates are lower, then firms can borrow at a lower interest rate, and they'll invest in building more factories and hiring more workers. That's the typical theory. Interest rates pretty much are close to zero for the federal government. What's actually of importance, though, to private businesses is the interest rates that they can borrow at. So a corporation like, General Motors can borrow at something like not AAA, but some level lower than that. So they have to pay a higher interest rate. Fed can try to influence that indirectly, but it's hard. There's another set of firms that never get to borrow by issuing bonds. They're like small businesses. And so the Fed has always had a hard time getting small business to be able to borrow. Because what banks do when times are bad is they don't just raise the interest rates they face. They essentially sort of lock them out of the business of being able to borrow because they're too much of a credit risk. It's not because they're mean, but there's their businesses themselves, these banks. And so the Fed has had typically a limited ability to do that. And in this particular case, in this particular instance, they tried to undertake the Main Street lending facility where they're trying to encourage banks, private banks, to lend to small firms.
Many companies are looking for a line of credit to get through this time, although they don't know how much time they need this credit.
That's right. They don't know. There's tremendous uncertainty. And so they might either be afraid of borrowing, or even if they know they need to borrow in order to continue. The problem is the Fed is not set up to lend to even big firms directly. We have wanted the Federal Reserve to be sort of out of the business of directly lending to banks and firms directly. So the Fed operates in these markets, bond markets, for instance. And so here, they've tried to set up a facility where they still don't directly lend to small firms, but they will buy the loans that banks have issued to small firms.
Mm-hmm.
That's a new program, entirely new, built from scratch in the essentially last 3 months. The problem is, it's you got to get the private banks to lend to small firms, and just generally, you can imagine, even if the risk is being reduced by this Fed program, they don't either have the ability to or the desire to lend to small firms. Who are exactly the firms that need the funds the most?
UW-Madison Professor of Public Affairs and Economics Menzie Chin is with us through the hour, taking your questions as we look at the economic consequences of COVID-19 and the many facets on our economy. What questions do you have about the Federal Reserve, the central bank, and the Trump administration and Congress and how they're managing the economic fallout? 800-642-1234. We'll pick this up after a news update on the Ideas Network. We're looking at the economic situation amid the pandemic here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The top Democrat on the Senate Banking Committee, Sherrod Brown of Ohio, had a stark message last week for the Federal Reserve Chair.
As COVID-19 spread across the country earlier this year, many workers, mostly black and brown, found themselves thrown from one crisis into the next. As it currently stands, with no steps taken to actually ensure the money they're lending goes to workers, Treasury and the Fed are only reinforcing the inequities between workers and Wall Street and between black and brown Americans and white Americans.
What questions do you have about these disparities and the economy? What parallels do you see between the Great Recession and what is unfolding now? 800-642-1234. Menzie Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. He stays with us. Let's take a call now. Bob is joining us from Mauston. Hi, Bob.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, well, we talk about economic recovery. It has to start out here at the farm. The farm prices right now are some of the worst that we've seen, and there is no margin. And until rural America, your farmers, start making a margin, it will not progress on recovery until they do. And this has been proven time and time again ever since the 1930s. And you want to start at the top and so on. No, you got to start at the bottom if you're building anything.
Bob, thank you. Menzie, you know, building back the country involves focusing on rural America, Bob said, and bringing back farmers.
Well, I think the rural economy is very important to the U.S. economy in general, and I would say we don't want to focus in on just the cities, and we just don't want to focus in on high finance and so forth, or the people who can work from their offices by remote working. We do want to focus in on the parts of society that were suffering before the recession and are suffering disproportionately. And that means those workers are particularly low wage occupations, let's say meatpacking, as well as the rural industry in general. I'll just say that we have the current problem overlaying a previous problem. Agricultural prices were hit in large part by a strong dollar, long-term trends, and the trade war that the president embarked upon starting in 2018. I mean, you can look at soybean prices dropping essentially $1.50 starting from the time that the president embarked upon his struggle essentially with China over essentially the Section 301 actions where he charged unfair trading practices by China. And it's never recovered. Despite the promises. Well, that was a big hit to the agricultural sector, agricultural exports. I mean, soybeans are the single largest agricultural export of the United States if I look by commodity. So yes, I would say we want the agricultural economy to recover, but aside from doling out money in vast amounts in essentially deficiency payments, they're called, which the president has done in an unprecedented manner, at least back to the 1930s, there's been nothing to help the agricultural sector. Essentially, it's been a Band-Aid. We hurt the ag sector overall by engaging in the trade war, and then we just doled out money to minimize the hurt.
Wisconsin led the nation in dairy farm bankruptcies heading into this pandemic.
Exactly. I mean, the president made a lot of statements about how it was going to be fixed. It's not clear to me how some of the long-term problems can be fixed because, we have rising productivity and demand is lagging, let's say, for dairy. So you have these two massive forces moving against the dairy sector, but we could have done better. Part of the thing is the strong dollar. Part of it is just engaging in a trade war is not helpful.
Let's bring in Carol now in Milwaukee. Carol, hi.
Hi, good morning. I have another business. We have a historic property where we do cultural events. We do meetings, wedding venues, retreats in-house, and day activities. And to some, that doesn't seem like a very important industry. But I think when economic hard times come, we lose cultural places. We lose cultural arts. We go to crisis intervention, and we lose so much that makes our neighborhoods and our society livable and interesting. And I'm just wondering what your guest has to say about those of us that have been shut down now for 4 or 5 months in venues that really looks like on the horizon we might not convene places or activities for another 3 to 6 months.
Carol, thank you. Yeah. Menzi, what about these places that bring community together for special events?
Well, I mean, I think of this as part of the, so much of the American economy is involved in services, delivery of services. That's a broad issue. It's true much more so than the last time we had a pandemic, 1918-1919, in the flu pandemic of that time. Back then, industry was much more important. So services, including these important cultural services, rise much more prominently in the economy. And then, of course, the cultural aspects are very hard to quantify for economists, by virtue of the very fact they don't go through markets. But I think they're very important. Now, what you could do, and what I think is important, is the states at the locality level could support lots of these things because they are important to enriching the lives of people within the state, because they're important to tourism, for instance, which supports jobs. The problem I see there, the thing that I can speak to, is that the federal government so far has not been particularly willing to give aid to the states. And the states are going to be looking at a shortfall of something on the order of $600 billion over the next two fiscal years. The next fiscal year starts at end of this month. And if there's no more aid forthcoming from the federal government, sort of transfers to help the fact that states have no tax revenues coming in or a lot less and much higher expenses, then you're going to see a big retrenchment coming up, a massive retrenchment. You already seen millions of jobs being lost in state governments and localities. Well, those will become much more permanent coming forward, and then you're going to lose, along with essential services, these cultural services that are being provided, either being supported directly or indirectly via the state through grants and so forth. So I agree that we don't want to just throw everything away in this sort of emergency response and saying just only the essentials. But I think if you give assistance to the states and the localities from the federal government that has the ability to borrow, then you can mitigate many of these hits that are going to take place otherwise.
We're talking about the recession with UW-Madison Professor Menzi Chin, who teaches public affairs and economics, taking your questions at 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Chris now in Milwaukee. Hi, Chris.
Hi. I first want to agree that states really need to be reimbursed by the Fed. That should be a no-brainer. But what I really want to talk about is going forward. All we have to do is give a universal basic income, just throwing out the $1,200 and the $500 that they did as a monthly stipend. Not saying that those numbers are right, but they were pretty good in the recent past. To pay for it, we just tax the billionaires, just change the tax structure, we'll have the money. When people get their universal basic income, they start putting it into the economy, and then the local and state economies will get better. But it's easy. Universal basic income, tax the billionaires.
Chris, thanks for the call. Menzi, what do economists say about universal basic income? How does it work in the economy?
Well, I'm not by any means an expert on this particular issue. I mean, the point is, in the pilot experiments that have been undertaken, I can't remember in which country it was, you know, the idea is you give a minimal amount of income to people to subsist so that, you know, they're not living from paycheck to paycheck all the time, but you do it in such a way that they still retain incentive to work, to find higher paying jobs, and so forth, and you mitigate all sorts of sort of like short-term behavior that isn't helpful by doing so. The question is, I mean, there's a political question. Do you have the consensus with the United States to do that, to tax in order to do that? That's not my area. But then the other issue is, you know, what amount of funds would you need to get to obtain that? And so that's an important question. You know, what would tax rates have to rise to in order to implement universal basic income, which was up to the levels? You might say tax the billionaires. Well, I don't think, you know, it would be hard. I think it's sort of an issue of, can you raise taxes sufficiently and capture the revenue? Because, of course, the billionaires have great accountants. They can try to shift around their money and hide it. Idea of a wealth tax, I mean, to me it appeals, but then there's once again a question of, can you tax it at a rate and effectively enough to capture enough revenue to finance these things?
So it's
then it becomes...
Yeah, go ahead.
Go ahead.
It will be, it becomes a really tricky issue as to where the money is flowing and how it gets to the right place, the right sources.
Yes, and I would say, you know, if universal basic income was a good idea before, it's probably even better in this situation. But it's a longstanding issue. And I'll just say, you know, from what little I know, as time goes on and we have more jobs being, you know, subject to possibly being automated out, maybe it becomes a more pressing issue to figure out how we can come to something more like that. But, you know, in the short term, you know, we want to incentivize people, I think, not to go out and work when they're likely to infect other people and make the pandemic worse. That's the short-term implication I take from this.
Menzi Chin, our guide, UW-Madison Professor of Public Affairs and Economics, will be back in a minute here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Federal Reserve officials on Friday warned that the U.S. economic outlook remained wildly uncertain as parts of the country see a surge in new coronavirus infections. The results of the Fed's annual stress tests on banks will be released this week and will include three new scenarios. Are you worried that banks and the financial system will be able to withstand the pandemic? What banking reforms are you looking for to help in the long-term recovery of our economy? Still time to talk. 800-642-1234. Menzi Chin is a professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison and stays with us. Let's take another call now. Ken is joining us from Boston. Hi, Ken.
Hi, how you doing? Well, you know, the good professor said something about, you know, the federal government should bail out states. I vehemently disagree. What incentive is there for states to act responsibly if they're going to be bailed out. And, you know, why should I bail out, say, California or Illinois because of their profligate spending and profligate and irresponsible spending? You know, and the other thing is this economy will not recover until the governments at every level take less. The more the government takes, the less the private sector has, and ultimately all wealth is created in the private sector.
Ken, thanks for that. Menzie, how would you respond to that for not, you know, bailing out states?
Well, we bail out states all the time, and indirectly. You think about it, in New York and the profligate California are actually net contributors to it's, you know, for instance, we heard from Mitch McConnell several months ago saying he'd be happy with letting the states go bankrupt. Well, he's trying to imply that, you know, his state is particularly responsible. But in point of fact, Kentucky is a net recipient of funds from the federal government. So this stereotype of profligate, you know, high income states, you know, maybe they're profligate, but on net, they're giving money to subsidize states like Kentucky and the other states of the South. So let's dispel with that particular issue here. Now, what about if we just all tighten our belts? Sounds really good. Well, we've tried that. Tightening the belts occurred in Europe in the wake of the 2008-2009 recession. What'd they get? They got the 2010-2011 recession because as states cut spending, raised taxes to try to shrink their budget deficits, what happened was that their economies shrunk, the employment went into decline further. As their employment went down and economic activity declined, tax revenues declined further. They had to pay more out in, let's say, unemployment insurance equivalents. So, in fact, austerity worsened and actually induced the, in part, the recession in 2010. Now, in the U.S., the recession that ended in 2009, well, we were on a recovery, but part of the reason why the recovery was so slow is because states like Wisconsin decided, well, here's a time to cut taxes and cut spending. Well, sounds good. If everything else stays the same, then your budget deficit's going to shrink. But if everything else doesn't stay the same, like as you raise taxes and or you cut spending on, let's say, teachers and other activities, then what's going to happen is you'll depress economic activity and tax revenues will either not grow or they'll decline and you worsen the problem. So the question as we face this nationwide possibility of having state governments retrench is, does that just lead into a greater contraction and greater budget deficits or requirements to cut spending further, which then cuts economic activity even further? To me, that just doesn't make sense.
So if there is a second stimulus, what effect would that have on our economy, on our banking sector, on individual households?
I think I can say for one point is if there's not a second stimulus, so there's in the works another maybe trillion and a half package coming up, because, for instance, the Republicans for sure will not let the PPP, the Paycheck Protection Program, run out of money because they have a constituency of businesses. But that's going to continue. The question is, you know, if you don't give money to the states and for them to keep up economic activity, if you don't give the increase, remember, unemployment insurance paychecks are augmented by $600 temporarily. Those things run out at the end of this month, end of July.
End of July.
So if you don't extend those things, we are going to have a slowdown. It's sort of baked in. The recovery so far is sort of baking in some additional stimulus. Don't give that stimulus. And in particular, I think if you let the states, as the gentleman said, let them tough it out themselves, I'm pretty sure we're going to have a slowdown of some sort, and or recovery won't be as quick as you would have thought. Going forward, it really depends upon how much uncertainty is removed. As I mentioned before, if there's tremendous economic uncertainty and uncertainty about government policies, then how do you expect business people? I agree, private sector creates bulk of the wealth in this country. How do you expect them to make reasoned decisions about where to build new factories? I would just hold off if I have no certainty about where government policy is going.
We're looking at the economic situation with Menzi Chin, a public affairs and economics professor at UW-Madison. Menzi, we're seeing a lot of bankruptcies from companies, household brand companies, companies with $1 billion or more in debt. What kind of losses are you seeing in Chapter 11 filings, and what does that mean for the broader economy?
Well, I can't say that I have any particular crystal ball that's going to tell me about what's going to happen, except to say that so far we've seen minimal impact for two reasons. One is, unlike in the 2008 recession, the origin of the crisis or the downturn is not in the financial sector. The origin is we have a pandemic which forces us to cut back on, implement restrictions on economic activity. So the origin of the crisis is not the financial sector. But over time, if we don't undertake policies meant to competently mitigate the hit, you will, of course, see more bankruptcies. The companies that had some funds to weather the crisis so far, as they were shut down, they'll run out of money. The government money that has been dispersed so far through the PPP will run out unless we replenish it. And then, the point about letting the states tough it out, the states are going to have to retrench. Already, employment by the states has gone down by millions in aggregate. If that's going to persist, then economic, the income that those guys would have received before is going to disappear. That will further induce a spiral downwards. And then, if there's no business for the businesses, then you are definitely, going to see more bankruptcies. So I think to a certain extent, we've been lulled into this complacency because we have, with much more alacrity than I would have expected, given the paralysis in government, we did give lots of money to private businesses through PPP and indirectly through the Federal Reserve dropping interest rates. That's been some support. But over time, those things are going to run out or they'll dissipate relative to, the downturn, even if we're recovering somewhat. So we're going to see more bankruptcies.
Menzi, in our final moments together here, what economic data, what numbers are you watching that may be coming out in the near term that could give us a clearer picture?
The employment numbers, both unemployment insurance numbers, which are reported every week, usually on Thursdays, at the federal level at least, and then employment numbers, those are government statistics that are high frequency, weekly and monthly. And so you want to see how fast employment is recovering as an indicator of economic activity. The problem is that it is not necessarily true that the faster employment grows, the better off we are in going forward, because if it means that faster re-employment means you're spreading the epidemic more rapidly, so that in the longer term you have to ratchet back much more harder, then that's a problem. Otherwise, there's various higher frequency indicators like sales and so forth that we can look to.
Well, Menzi, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me on.
Menzi Chin, professor of public affairs and economics at UW-Madison. More conversation about the economy with Thursday. Patty Hirsch from Planet Money returns. That's Wednesday at 8. This is the Ideas Network.